I propose to talk this evening generally on theosophy and how to approach the whole subject of what theosophy is. There is the concept. It is a concept for us, although a truth to those who know that man is spirit, soul, intellect, the mind that we commonly use, emotions and body. He has a constitution that ranges, as it were, from the most subjective to the most objective. I believe it is Dr. Besant who has said that man unites in himself the highest spirit with the lowest matter. If that be the case, what we call theosophy must include the truth at all these levels. And in embracing this truth, one might begin either from below, from our plane, the facts which are observable by us, the events of everyday life, or we might begin from above, that is to say, from the unity of the spirit. If we begin from below, we go up level by level. And that is what Brother Leadbeater does in his books, which makes his writings very intelligible to all of us. But it is also possible to start from above, as H.P. Blavatsky does in The Secret Doctrine, in that part which is entitled Cosmogenesis. And then if we start at that highest point, then we have to move downwards. We have to trace the whole way, so far as we can, which the one life or the one spirit takes. In moving outwards, it seemingly divides itself and manifests itself at various levels under different limitations. These are two ways of dealing with the whole subject. One way is to build up a kind of pyramid of knowledge, starting from the most objective and ending in some sublime subjective reality of which we can hardly have any definite cognizance. But the other is to form some conception of the spirit or touch the reality at some point and trace the ways in which it veils itself and manifests itself at different levels, and in that way come down to the plane of the heaviest limitations, namely the physical world. Now when I say that we have to have some conception of the truth which is the spirit, it is not really conception, because our conception may be true or false. Often our conceptions, even of the most sublime truths, are projections from an ignorant background, so that they are more misconceptions than conceptions. We have to have a consciousness of the truth. Even that is not a correct way of saying, because you are not conscious of the truth as we are conscious of things, there being a dividing distance between the truth and the cognizing mind. There has to be a self-identification with the truth. In other words, you have to experience that truth, which is somewhere higher up, or more correctly, deeply within. And then it would be possible to find out what are its connections with the human consciousness, and how this consciousness extends downwards and outwards into various concrete realities. Now, the spirit is usually called the highest principle in man. But I do not know whether the word principle is the correct word to use. But we use it in the absence of another. When you use the word principle, it brings to your mind an idea of something which is articulated and defined, something which is related to various other principles perhaps, or related in some way to various facts which that principle explains. But spirit in reality is susceptible to no such limitations. The mind has to cease to identify itself with everything that it knows before it can know what the spirit is. It has to part company with all the ideas with which it has associated itself. It has even to dissociate itself from its own thoughts and become, so to say, as nothing before it can have or feel a faint touch of that reality which is the spirit. There are those who have done so, and it is only they who can know what it is and speak of this wisdom, which is theosophy, from that level. But even people like ourselves can know something of that supreme or spiritual wisdom by its manifestations at lower levels. HPB makes a strong distinction between head learning and soul wisdom. She regards head learning as really an obstacle to the attainment of this wisdom which she calls soul wisdom. Every living thing, of course, from the standpoint of occultism, there is nothing which is devoid of life, has a soul, although that soul may not be individualized, made so definite and distinctive as the soul of a human being. So from the standpoint of this philosophy, there is the soul even for an electron. We do not know what the electron is, assuming it is the tiniest thing that we can speak of or think of. Even that has a soul of some sort. But that soul, like everything that exists, is in a state of evolution. From the standpoint of occultism, evolution is not confined to what we call animate things. It is not a subject merely for the students of biology. The whole universal process is an evolutionary process. Everything is unfolding in some way. And if there is the soul nature in each thing as well as in ourselves, all that is exterior to it really exists for its sake, because it is that which unfolds from within. It is a reality, it is a certain beauty. We do not know what terms to use with regard to it, but everything that exists, everything material, is merely to evolve the means for its self-revelation, for its unfoldment. So long as we do not take into account this unfoldment, we do not perceive or understand its nature and purpose, all the learning that we acquire is only head learning. I am trying to explain what is head learning. Is all learning worthless? But if you can relate what you learn, the information which you possess, the facts that you collect to this process of a manifestation which is taking place, but a manifestation of the one thing, then perhaps the head learning has an element of soul wisdom in it, and we need not despise it altogether. After all, a knowledge of relevant facts pertaining to the formal aspect of things is not inconsistent with a knowledge of life, of that which uses the form, the nature of which is expressed in the form. If you say soul wisdom is what we want, then the question arises, what is the use of learning? Is there any learning which is worthwhile? And my answer would be, if we can learn those relevant facts by which this process of an unfoldment from a spiritual center, which is the very heart of the universe, can be understood, then that learning is of value. We need not, I think, set the form against the life, because form and life are meant to match each other. They go together. All forms in the evolutionary process, every form that you can think of, man, animal, tree, anything, all forms are meant to become so refined, so spiritualized, that they perfectly fit the indwelling life or the soul, so that there is no longer any distinction between life and form. That, I believe, is the end towards which everything is moving. There is the beauty that is seeking manifestation, but it does not have the form or the means of manifesting itself, and therefore the form or the means has to be evolved in order to make that beauty manifest. But even an imperfect form can be an expression of the indwelling life and does give a hint sometimes, more than a hint, of the nature of that life. We often read a person's nature or character from his look and from his manner. Well, it is because what is in his heart and in his mind in some way expresses itself outwardly. Therefore, the outer form or the outer expression, it gives you a certain hint of the reality that is being expressed, or whatever it is that is being expressed. So we need not, as it were, regard any knowledge that we may obtain with regard to the formal side of things as useless. But that knowledge has to be related to the evolution of life. Then we will be able to have soul wisdom and knowledge or learning pertaining to that wisdom. And we need not call it head learning. Now, wisdom itself does not consist in knowing merely the nature of the form, the elements which compose it. You can dissect the human body and put it all on a map, all the dissected portions, but that would not give you any idea of the life that was within the body or the soul which inhabits the body. But we have maybe said to have some wisdom when we know the nature of the life for which the body is the instrument or the vehicle. Now I say this because there is so much in theosophy which is a kind of description. There are so many facts which are related. All that is, as it were, the form side which is capable of description. But there is something which cannot be described. Therefore, there is a vast area of truth which one can try to imagine if he wants to, but which one has to discover and experience by himself. There are only certain things which can be put into words, which can be given to you in the form of pictures. And that is what we find in theosophical literature. So there is something besides what you find in the books. The true nature of things, the quality of things, which has to be discovered by or experienced by each one for himself. After all, what we can put down in any book must consist of words, and words are merely symbols. And so far as words refer to concrete things, we can easily picture them. But when the word refers to something which is of the nature of an abstraction or a subjective experience, then the word will mean just what the listener or the reader understands in that symbol and not anything more. So we have, in reading about so many things, the higher consciousness, nirvana, atman, the spirit and all that, we have to go beyond the words and try, if we can, to sense the truth, the meaning, the life which is indicated by that word. Our communication of theosophy has to be at levels where communication is possible to us. If a parent wants to bring up a child, he or she can tell the child how to behave, can tell the child how to salute somebody who comes, what words to use when you meet the person for the first time in the day. You can do all that, how to dress and all that. But how to teach compassion? You can say, well, when you see an animal, you and see a hurt, then you do what you can to heal the hurt or bring relief. Yes, but that is an outer action. But compassion is an inner feeling. Or sake reverence. How to make the child feel all those beautiful things of which you yourself are capable in your heart, assuming you are the parent. But all these things are really communicated to the child in some intangible manner. It is through vibrations, you might say, and the child nature, being unspoiled, is able quickly to seize those vibrations and vibrate accordingly, so that whatever are the beautiful feelings of the parent or the teacher communicates itself in some subtle manner to the child. But that is how, of course, a person learns music. Music consists of notes, but merely to pick up the notes is not to respond to music. Music has in it a beauty by which one has to be moved. And there are people who are not moved at all by any music, however beautiful. But how can you make a person who is not at all responsive musically to appreciate its beauty, to be moved from the depth of his heart? You can't do that. But the proximity of people, the influence which a person exerts intangibly, invisibly on others, all that has a certain effect. That is why it is sometimes useful to listen to a talk by somebody who can help in addition to reading, because after all, there is the influence of the person. But as I said, we can communicate only at those levels where communication is possible, that is, at the verbal or the mind level, communicating in the ordinary way. But then you can communicate subtly and influence people if they are susceptible to that influence. There are things which are indicated by abstract words such as beauty, wisdom and truth. Suppose I go on talking and at every other turn I use these abstract words, they are all abstract, then what is it that the person will understand by them? It depends very much upon what he has experienced of these things for himself. There are certain truths which cannot be conveyed directly, but they can be conveyed through metaphors and symbols. And this was the method which has been used from the most ancient times. Plato, for instance, indulges, is that the word, I don't know, in an elaborate allegory about the cave and the men who were in front of it. But all that was only a suggestion to the sensitive imagination of his hearers or readers. You will find that whenever you read about spiritual matters, the spiritual consciousness, the virtues and all these subtle qualities which belong to the higher nature of man, you have invariably to use metaphors, flowery language. Not that you want to use flowery language, but there is no other way of indicating the things to which you refer. Theosophy has necessarily to assume largely, I'm stressing the word largely, the form of a philosophy, which includes science. Of course, it bases itself entirely upon facts. It never contradicts reason. And throughout, the thought is logical. So in the true sense of the term, theosophy is scientific. But yet at the same time, since it does not deal merely with particular facts, but also with processes of consciousness, since it seeks to order facts in a certain way, since it deals with matters which belong to the human consciousness, one might, for all ordinary purposes, call it a philosophy. But since it is a philosophy in which very much more is veiled than is revealed, we have to call it also the esoteric philosophy. And that is the phrase which HPB constantly used. Every philosophy must be consistent with the facts of one's experience, if it is at all to be convincing or if it is to be practical. The facts, the observed processes, there are so many processes of the human consciousness as well as in the biological systems of various things, and the laws pertaining to them, all this falls within the province of philosophy. We often say theosophy is a synthesis of philosophy, science and religion. And it might be well to have some idea of what comes under the category of philosophy and what science and so on. Our theosophical literature, as to the various things that are to be found at the astral and mental levels, particularly the scenery and the things which seem objective, which can be observed, all that and the information that we have about various globes of the different chains and so on, are all facts which have been observed. Therefore, they would belong to the category of science, even though it may not be science in the ordinary sense, which deals only with physically observable phenomena. Anything which is observed, which is objective, which may be accurate or inaccurately conveyed, is really comes under the province of science. So, all the information that we have about all that, globes, chains, rounds and all that, astral plane and so on, nature, spirits, etc., all come under the category of scientific observation. It may lend itself to a wise ordering of one's life, but in itself it will not constitute wisdom. You may know anything about various planets and even solar systems and all that, and you may categorize and classify them and group them and constitute and make maps and charts and trees and everything else. You can have all that, but still you may not possess even the most elementary wisdom with regard to the ordinary things of one's life. I am making here a distinction. I don't mean to say that it is not of value. All knowledge can be used wisely, but the mere possession of facts, whether they are facts of the outer world or facts observed otherwise, if they are merely facts, they will not constitute wisdom. Wisdom lies in how you use knowledge, how you react to the facts which you know, how you react to the things with which you come into contact. And since theosophy is, according to the literal meaning of the word theosophia, a wisdom, we have to know what is wisdom as distinguished from mere knowledge or head learning, to use HPB's phrase. The information that we have is of course priceless, I would call it so, because it shows the broad plan of nature. But then you must know what is achieved by that plan. That is of importance. Man needs really an outline of the whole of which he is a part. He has to know his relationship to the universal process, his true relationship to his fellow beings, in order that he may live his life wisely, in accordance with the truth of things, and not merely according to imaginations, false ideas, superstitious beliefs, and so on. There are some people who do not particularly care for all this information about the chains, rounds, globes, and so on. But that is how life or the life wave moves. That is the fact of the matter. A person may care for it or may not care for it. That depends upon himself. But I must say this. It is not necessary to know or believe all that to live a pure and noble life. You need not know anything about any chain or round, or even about previous races. But you can be a beautiful personality, you can live a helpful life. It is possible to do that. It is possible to be a true theosophist without possessing all that information, even though that information is of extreme interest to those who are able to appreciate its significance. It is not the horizontal expansion of our knowledge, expanding knowledge on the plane on which we live, which I think is important. But what is important for a man is the uprising of the pure inner flame, that is to say, those things which belong to his heart, that his love, his capacity for sympathy, his capacity to surrender himself, all those things. It is those things which really constitute the factors of one's spiritual life. course, there are people who will say, I am not interested in all these things because I am only concerned with my own spiritual life. But one has to be very careful not to use that term spiritual life merely to an enjoyment of inner sensations. There is something that inwardly he pursues and that is so pleasing, so satisfactory and enjoyable that he is prepared to forget the rest of the world. In other words, what is called spiritual life becomes a kind of private enjoyment in which the person revels. And so he secludes himself in the rest of the world so that he may not be disturbed in this wonderful experience which he is having. But even that is certainly a form of selfishness, if I might use such a strong term. That is on the one side. But on the other side, it may be said that there are many people who have a restless thirst for more and more sensations in the form of mysterious revelations. All the time they seek what they call occult knowledge. That is to say, they just want the excitement of something new. And that is a thirst which, like thirst for any other sensation, only increases through indulgence. Of course, it can be slaked to a certain extent, but then after a time you will want more information. So I myself think that this thirst for various occult tidbits and so on which people seek is also a form of distracting oneself from one's own path of righteousness and responsibility. So on the one hand, you have to appreciate and evaluate the knowledge which comes to you. You must know how to use it wisely. You must have, on the other hand, not this kind of restless curiosity, the desire for something exciting, which you call occult. It very often is fantastic. So, all along the way, there has to be an attitude of balance, neither leaning heavily to one side nor to the other. Wisdom is not knowledge, as I have just said, but all knowledge, whether of this outer world or of the inner worlds, can be used wisely. Wisdom has been spoken of as the breath of the power of God. I'm sure you are all acquainted with that phrase. Well, if it is the breath of a certain power, it is not just an accumulation of facts or accumulation of knowledge. It is not something static, but it is something living, breathing and moving. The breath, of course, refers to the spirit or the one life. And wisdom is an attribute of the spirit. So it is really a quality. It is not just a store of information or knowledge. It is a certain quality which is manifested in life. That is to say, in action, in the way one lives. Insofar as theosophy is the wisdom of the spirit, it is a way of life more than anything else. It's a way of life which develops a certain capacity to attract truth to itself. If there is any truth which comes within the magnetic field of that person, then he will be attracted to that truth. So you become, as it were, a magnet for truth. It is the capacity to perceive the truth when you come across it, or to sense it when it is present before you. It is that which is more important than possessing a few beliefs which you can carry in your pocket. It is a way of life, I said. It's a way of life of brotherhood, which is an expression of the unity of the spirit. And it is that which makes a real theosophist. Of course, we all understand brotherhood in a way, but we do not know the depth and beauty of it. In one of the Mahatma letters, there is reference to a practical and regenerating brotherhood. The master speaks of brotherhood as a kind of relationship or a force, you might say, which is capable of regenerating the individual. We all profess brotherhood, but I don't know whether we are regenerated already or going to be regenerated. So we see that brotherhood is something which is much deeper. If I said, instead of using the word brotherhood, if somebody uses some other word, say a capacity to commune with the inner spirit or life of all things, of all beings, then of course that would sound grand. But brotherhood just implies that, because it is the sharing of one life by which you feel your own deep spiritual inner kinship with others. But as I have pointed out in previous speeches, we must not forget that there are the differences. It is not really forgetting the differences or trying to convince ourselves that there is no difference between you and me. There are differences at the physical and mental level, but if we go deeply underneath those differences, then we will automatically come into a region where you know the unity as a fact. It must be a life of brotherhood and a life that is devoted to the highest ends. Now, since man is not only spirit or soul but also intellect, on the intellectual plane, theosophy is the truth of things. Wisdom, I said, is a certain quality which is manifested in living and in action. But on the intellectual plane, theosophy, I would say, is that truth which at one level is spiritual and at other levels intellectual or perhaps even material. That which is unity in the spirit is perceived always at the intellectual level as a unity in diversity. It is like the white light breaking into all its component colors, so that when there is something which is realized on the spiritual plane and you bring it down to the next lower level, you find that at the next lower level it is not just a point, but it is an expansion. So there is always the breaking up of the unity so that it delivers up the meanings which are contained within it. Theosophy proclaims the unity and explains the diversity. In ancient days, the stress was on unity. Of course, in those days, people lived a physically restricted life. There were not so many ways in which people could occupy themselves. Many people were born and died in the village, in the same village, and perhaps they did not travel very far. And there were no such things as television or radio or various newspapers and journals and all that. Therefore, people had no way of distracting themselves except by going to the neighbor and disturbing his peace. So they lived under disabilities, as we might think. And when there are not many things claiming one's attention, the tendency of people is generally to go to sleep. Unless you are able to keep your attention occupied with something, then the attention just sinks back. This is, of course, a normal experience. So in those days, probably people lived a comparatively sleepy life. Those were ages of drowsiness, as we might say, except, of course, for some who had their own interior resources to fall back upon. When man is denied an outlet into the external world, he somehow makes a way within himself, and in that way he comes to certain great truths or realizations which, of course, we do not think of at all, because all the time we are running away from ourselves. But if we are to call those ages of drowsiness, they might well retort and call the present age an age of delirium, which I think would be strictly true. We are living in a time of the development of the mind, which is dominated by matter and sensation. And I think that this mind has to turn upwards towards the spirit and become a vehicle of its richness. A mind which is merely trained in technique, when it is apart from its technique and is not occupied with it, will be very largely a barren mind, an empty mind. Life does not give you its riches when the mind is occupied merely with doing so many things that do not give you an inner enrichment. So when we say the mind has to turn to the spirit, it doesn't mean that all the people must become religious in the conventional sense. I don't mean that at all. It means a certain enrichment of the human heart. All those things which fill your soul with beauty, with happiness and so on, it is the capacity to respond to those things and find them within oneself which makes a person really spiritual. A spiritual man is one who is inwardly rich, even though he may outwardly live an extremely simple life. So this human mind, which is very much like a twig that is now bent downwards towards the ground, that is to say the field of matter, has in some way to take an upward turn towards that sunlight, which of course will make all the difference to its life. And I believe that the Theosophical Society was founded in order that humanity may be helped to make this turn. That is to say, there has to come about a change in the human consciousness, which instead of all the time turning outwards to the various differences in the material field, has, as it were, to turn to the true significance of things. As I said the other day, it has to have an aesthetic intuition of the beauty that is in things, that is in people, that is in so many phenomena of life. But we miss very much because of the fact that this mind is so extremely active and concerned with the superficial things of life. Of course, the society was founded long ago, but you see that still the world is very far from having made any kind of a decisive turn towards a new era. There is a great deal more to be done, I think, before the desired changes can take place.